coming up on the My Ag Life Daily News Report, science and agriculture, how an organization is working to get more STEM graduates involved in ag. That is today's segment four. It's a great conversation and an important one, so make sure you tune into that. Plus, we'll have today's news brief. But first, it's Tuesday, and that means a check-in on citrus. On the phone with me today is Southern California citrus grower Chris Sayer, manager and partner of Petty Ranch, which he describes as a 130-ish-year-old family farm in Southern California's Ventura County, where they grow lemons and avocados. Here's our conversation.
So last time we talked mostly about avocados, and this time I want to talk to you about your lemons. And how's citrus going for you out there?
Well, better than last year. You know, one of the things with citrus is that, particularly lemons, a lot of it is used in the food service and restaurant world. And as you can imagine, the last 12 months have not been great for an industry that depends on moving about 50% of its product through those channels. This year, of course, things are looking a little bit better. The dropping infection rates, the opening up, the increasing access to the vaccines are certainly playing a big role in helping restaurants open up, and it looks like that's going to be helping lemon sales too.
Did it change your plans at all for this year with everything we went through last year, and still we're already in April and, you know, uncertainty continues this year? Were any of your plans changed?
Not in the big scheme of things. With tree crops, you don't have the advantage of being very nimble. The trees are in the ground for about 40 years or so, you don't really have to turn on a dime. It is changing how we approach harvesting the fruit. The pricing is actually fairly good for large, high quality, the most desirable fruit that usually gets sold through grocery stores direct to customers. That is actually doing okay. It's, the smaller second grade fruit that is really having trouble finding a home. And so the one thing that has changed for us is it's accelerated our decision to retire a few older trees that were not really producing a lot of the high quality fruit. They're producing more of that, smaller second grade fruit, and without much of a price for that. We're taking the opportunity to get those out of the ground and get them replaced with younger trees that will hopefully do more for us in the years to come.
Can we talk a little bit more about that?
I'm sure.
Curious about how important is it, or if you would go into more detail about how important it is to have the higher quality, the top tier fruit that people want to buy. Is there, are people or companies very choosy? Do you need to maintain that top? Obviously, you're pulling out some older trees so that you can have the younger trees, which produce the more sought after fruit. Is it extremely important in the industry?
Yeah, the difference in pricing between first grade, large first grade fruit and smaller second grade fruit can be, over 100%. So it makes a huge difference. A bin of lemons is not a bin of lemons. It depends what's in the bin. So that's really causing us to reevaluate how long we're willing to sort of allow older trees that just aren't producing the quality that they used to continue, in the orchard. It's something that was happening before COVID, but the change in the market dynamics that COVID brought has certainly made it a lot more visible, and it's caused us to reevaluate a little bit how much patience we're going to have for older, weaker trees.
And talking about the COVID pandemic too, I do so many interviews, and I've done so many interviews in the last year about the effects of COVID, and this is my perception, and it could be totally wrong. Feel free to tell me. But it seems like in some of the industries, like meat industry, you can really see how the changes, with the restaurants closed, you can really see how those changes are affecting the meat industry. But then with other crops like lemons or even avocados, it almost, to me, feels like it's not quite as visible to the general public how big those changes have been for your industries, but they are just as big as they've been for the meat industries. Am I making sense there?
Yes, and I think generally that's right. Fortunately, I think we've fared better than some other, crop and produce categories. It was very gratifying to see that even when times were tough, people continued to buy lemons and avocados at the grocery store, and that really helped, make what could have been a truly terrible year financially into one which was not good, but it's 2021 now and we're still here, so
right.
Well, a lot of other businesses unfortunately can't the same, so
right. So with other challenges that you have faced, last time we talked you were facing some wind damage to the avocados, and we know that citrus has had some other challenges with pests. How are things going in that front?
From that standpoint, we're okay in terms of really dramatic events. We had some wind in January, which is going to cause a little bit more scarring, so that'll downgrade some of the fruit. And the bigger issue for us has been an extremely dry winter. We're pretty much at the end of the rainy season, and we've only got about 4.5 inches of rainfall for the year, whereas typically we'd be, up in the 18 to 20 inch range for this year. So a lot more irrigation, and that brings with it expense. But without getting all of that free, high quality water from the sky, that'll show up in our fruit quality as well. The fruit's not going to size quite as well. So that'll be tough in terms of having a lot of that, large first grade fruit that we were just talking about.
Now, I'm much better versed in water issues in Central California, in the Central Valley where I'm from, but you're from Southern California. Do you face the same problems with the water shortages? Where does your water come from?
Yeah, so fortunately for us, most of Ventura County's water comes from our own local watershed, and it feeds into a groundwater system that has been managed for nearly 100 years now. So while it's not a perfect system by any stretch of the imagination, it's actually not too bad. So this year we will see some drawdown in groundwater as everybody's pulling from it, but it shouldn't be too bad. We keep fairly good tabs on it, and so we're not looking at the same level of shortage or cutbacks that they face much more frequently in the Central Valley in particular.
So any other issues or anything else that you're looking at as we head further into spring?
Oh, well, the lack of rain is the big one, because that's going to end up driving our sizes lower, and so that's going to have an impact on us. Other than that, though, we're glad to see things opening up, and see people, headed back out to restaurants and consuming more lemons. It looks like things will recover this year, and so we're just moving ahead with our plans for replanting more avocados and lemon trees, and renewing our bet for the next 30 or 40 years.
Thank you again to Chris Sayer. Our news brief is coming up next. We'll be right back.
This segment was sponsored by the California Walnut Board. Agromayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayor has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayor can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Here's Here's your news brief for today from the California Farm Bureau. In search of plants that can withstand expected warmer temperatures, University of California scientists say they have identified a gene that helps plants sense heat. UC Riverside researchers report locating the gene, calling it an early step in being able to influence plants' temperature responses. The university said warmer temperatures can encourage plants to flower early and produce fewer seeds, reducing crop yields. Figures show U.S. agricultural exports this fiscal year have been stronger for longer than in many years. Gary Crawford has more.
U.S. agricultural exports for the first 5 months of this fiscal year, October through February, are running 26% ahead of the same time period a year ago. But if you look just at the numbers for February, you see this.
Agricultural exports dropped 15% from $16.2 billion to $13.9 billion.
USDA economist Bart Kenner says, in a way, though, there's a positive spin on that February decline.
If anything, this may be a little bit later than some years, as far as when we start to see that dip.
He says ag exports normally will peak in November, then start downward in December or January, so this dip's coming a little later. Likewise, the peak in monthly exports was later. Bart Kenner says one reason, that very late season surge of purchases by China.
That kind of drove that late year push to have that peak kind of extend a little bit longer than it does sometimes.
Also, the harvesting of competing crops in South America has been later than normal, so buyers have been coming to the U.S. a little later than normal, too. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The government of Canada is investing more than $6 million to help improve safety of agri-food workers in southwestern Ontario. They say supporting the workers is a priority for them. The support of up to $6.1 million through the Emergency Processing Fund is for 34 food processing companies in southwestern Ontario. Recipients are using the funding to make adjustments to enable social distancing, purchase reusable personal protective equipment, implement biosecurity measures, installing hand-washing stations and protective barriers, and developing employee training. How can producers better measure their crop yields and what it costs to generate those yields to create a greater measure of productivity and profitability? Rod Bain looks into it.
Productivity in agriculture. What does that mean? Purdue University's Alan Gray believes that
productivity is yield.
So how does productivity then become part of a producer's key decision-making processes, especially when focusing on profitability? Speaking at this year's Commodity Classic, Gray says it is important for a producer, regardless of crop, to consider overhead cost.
We're going to produce even if we might lose money. Why? Because fixed costs are fixed. They're going to be there whether we produce or we don't. So if we produce and we produce something and we get a price that's at least above our operating costs, then that means it's going to contribute towards fixed costs.
Also, producers need to consider profitability by crop measurement instead of per acre. So taking the example of corn per bushel.
What would bushels have had to be in order to break even? I can take that now and convert that into a percentage. So you can look at it from this perspective. What is the break-even yield gap in every year?
Gray adds that producers need to understand how to budget to make a positive margin.
You should calculate those costs per bushel by dividing by your expected yield so that you know whether or not you are budgeted to have a break-even position. Don't convert revenue to dollars per acre. Convert cost to dollars per bushel because we don't sell acres. We sell bushels.
So growers need to manage their input decisions based on the same units that they sell in.
The reason is spending additional money always appears to raise costs when you look at it on a per acre basis.
In turn, Gray says producers need to convert inputs and overhead into cost per bushel. This becomes important, especially when growers try to save money by reducing inputs and input cost. So less seeds planted may mean less inputs, saving costs there, but also means less yields per acre. And when factoring in other fixed items and overhead cost.
Land, machinery, those are fixed costs, and they're fixed costs to get spread over fewer bushels.
Which could mean an increase for the cost of those items per bushel, as well as the total cost to produce one bushel. And for the producer, a need to sell the crop at a higher price per bushel to make a profit. Gray adds similarly that an increase in inputs like a fungicide can also impact the break-even point for producers in a cost-per-bushel mode, especially if increased yields are the result.
Fixed costs are managed through productivity. That's why productivity matters so much.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Global food commodity prices rose in March, marking their 10th consecutive monthly increase, with quotations for vegetable oils and dairy products leading the rise. The Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, or the FAO, reported recently. The FAO Food Price Index, which tracks monthly changes in the international prices of commonly traded food commodities, averaged 118.5 points in March, 2.1% higher than in February, and reaching its highest level since June of 2014. Trends varied by commodity type. The March increase was led by the FAO Vegetable Oil Price Index, which rose 8.0% from the previous month to hit nearly a 10-year high, with soy oil prices rising sharply due in part to the prospects of firm demand from the biodiesel sector. Has the COVID pandemic changed our attitudes and behaviors around food? Consumer surveys say yes. We go to Gary Crawford once again.
Back in the 50s, a comedian Stan Freberg did a satire on the advertising industry, part of which was a mock commercial advertising just food.
Any time is the time for food, 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 food. Just put it in your mouth, chew it up with your teeth, and swallow it. You can bet your bottom dollar you'll say, food is good.
Yum. Oh, yeah. Of course, the need of advertising to make people enjoy food was funny, but over the last year or so, surveys show our attitude towards food has changed, and so have our food-related behaviors. Andy Harrigs with the Food Marketing Institute, which is constantly surveying Americans about food-related subjects, and he told a U.S. Department of Agriculture forum that back in 2019, only 10.5% of U.S. grocery dollars were spent weekly to buy groceries online, 10.5%. Then came COVID.
And you see this number shoot up. March through April 2020, all of a sudden it goes up to more than 27%, almost 28%. That is a big deal.
Meanwhile, we all were at home a lot. And Herrick says during this past year, there have been some major shifts in our attitude towards food. One, an uptick in simply our appreciation for having it, especially after those early days of the pandemic when grocery stores were having trouble stocking food. And so surveys have shown
people enjoy eating more. They're enjoying eating more at home. Then they're trying to eat healthier at home as well.
Of course, we really didn't have much choice about eating at home since at one point almost all the restaurants were shut down. And so surveys and sales records showed that more of us were preparing more meals at home and not just warming up already prepared foods either.
The people working from scratch, which we thought was really interesting that people were doing this. People are baking. We saw a run on baking supplies. So that was, I think, a really interesting dynamic. They're talking about planning more meals in advance, trying new dishes more often, being more adventurous.
And being more concerned about wasting food, but that was early to midway through 2020. However, as the pandemic has worn on and the novelty of at-home meal prep has worn off,
we're also seeing high levels of fatigue in dealing with food preparation. So we'll see how those two combat and kind of interact over the next 6 or 7 months.
Which brings us to the question, will we keep some of these attitudes and changes in behavior post-pandemic? Well, Herrick says as far as more online grocery shopping,
that is here to stay. So we are going to see a lot more of this online shopping.
But what about the other changes, the meals at home, the cooking from scratch, concern about food waste and such?
We're still trying to figure it out. So we're going to have to see in the long term, particularly once restaurants come back online and are a little bit more accessible to people, how people respond to this.
Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's our news brief for today. Still to come, we're talking STEM and ag in segment 4. Up next, though, supply chain vulnerabilities. We'll be right back.
Having problems with nematodes? ProMax is your number one solution. ProMax is a powerful fungicide, nematicide, that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. ProMax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRite Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/ProMax for more information.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. That is there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect. The COVID pandemic highlighted some areas of weakness in how we get food and goods. The Woodrow Wilson Center discussed supply chain vulnerabilities in a virtual panel Monday. Christopher Sands is the Wilson Center Canada Institute Director and talked about NAFTA, USMCA, and other trade issues.
I'm going to focus a little bit on North American supply chains, mainly because Canada, the United States, and Mexico share some of the most sophisticated supply chains in the world. You've heard of some of the areas that we have here: defense, obviously automotive, agriculture, food, energy, medical services. We already have these supply chains. They're fairly sophisticated and complex, and so we're building from a position of strength when we think about global supply chains in a regional context. That didn't happen on its own. It happened because the U.S. made a conscious effort to knit together our supply chains. And this is just a list. If you're a Canada watcher like me, some of this is easy to remember. But we first integrated our defense production process in 1956, integrated our auto industry's production starting in 1965. And then it's not always remarked on, but we approached our free trade agreements in North America using a rule of origin based system. And that put an emphasis on understanding the provenance of each piece of the supply chain. Now, the Canada's Free Trade Agreement started that. The rule of origin was modified for NAFTA. It was retained in USMCA. This gives us already a forward-thinking posture when it comes to the content of what we produce. So where Europe eliminating its borders and using an in or out system, you're either in Europe and the European Union or you're not, the way that North America developed its supply chains is extremely favorable to supply chain security and cooperation. Point out here just at the end also that because of those trade agreements and the rule of origin system, we also found ourselves collaborating on a special needs basis. And the United States and Canada in 2019 started and then launched in 2020 a joint action plan on critical minerals collaboration. Canada has about 13 of the 34 top minerals in significant quantities, and we're already working with Canada on bringing those supplies on into the market, which I think is another signal of the great cooperation we have. We also, in order to make this work, have extensive cooperation in customs facilitation, inspection, and regulatory alignment. I want to underscore this because after September 11, the United States and Canada began the Container Security Initiative, which became a pattern for what we did elsewhere. In fact, we rolled out the Container Security Initiative in December of 2001. That's how quickly we moved to put this together. And what that means is that at ports around the world, the U.S. and Canada jointly inspect containers, not only here in North America, but in places like Shanghai and Rotterdam, where we know each other's inspection protocols and we collaborate in making sure containers have what they're supposed to have. In addition, we have great border security cooperation. This is one of the reasons that where we've shut off international travel with some countries due to the pandemic, with Canada and also with Mexico, we have a joint border security approach that allows us to work together very seamlessly and move essential products in the supply chain back and forth across the border. Regulatory alignment is the last piece. It's something we could get better at, trying to reduce the regulatory burden on our companies. I'll talk about that in a minute. Now, the trends in North America are also really important. First, manufacturers are looking to increase the transparency and visibility of supply chains. Why? Because consumers want to know there's no forced labor involved in the production of what they're buying. And investors for environmental social governance want to know what's going into the supply chain and the company that I'm investing in, and does that reflect my values? At a time when supply chains connected to China are often quite opaque, North America is a leader in creating some of this visibility, which I think is very important. It's also necessary because as we decouple from the Chinese economy, as we start being more careful to look for sources of supply that aren't tainted or are inconsistent with our values, agility and resilience is really important. We need to be able to adjust flexibly and quickly, and we need to reduce the cost of operating in the supply chain, get back to that just in time that limits the amount of inventory in the supply chain. And as the congressman said, decoupling, reshoring, and even ally shoring, as people are starting to talk about now, really presents an opportunity to blur the line between alliance partners and trade partners. I think that's something that Ambassador Green has had as part of his vision of things, and I think he's quite right on that. So what do we do about it? A couple of things, just a few, promise. One, we need to do a better job of data mapping trade. Some of you will remember during the USMCA negotiations, we were actually being schooled by the Canadians who came around congressional district by congressional district to talk about what Canada did in terms of investment, job creation, employment in each and every congressional district. That's the power of data that we have because we have electronic bills of lading. There's a huge amount of data that's available for our North American supply chains now. But the U.S. government hasn't ever data mined that to start mapping out our trade linkages. So we still now think of Michigan, my home state, as being an important state for trade, and it is. But it's disproportionately counted because it's where goods first enter the U.S. We're missing the importance of trade to a lot of the middle of the United States. Now, in the USMCA, negotiators did something very important, which is they said that publicly collected data, with respect for privacy, of course, should be made available to the private sector. And I think as governments, we've never really mined the data that we have. There's a real potential to let the private sector begin mapping supply chains using data that's collected by DHS, by customs, as part of the everyday transactions that we already have. The data exists. And I think having the private sector step in and start using technology to help us get a better picture of supply chains is not only an opportunity, but I also think it will help us be more sophisticated about how we can fine-tune those supply chains. Next up, cybersecurity leadership. We are a Five Eyes partner with the Canadians, but that is primarily international intelligence. We could do much more commercial intelligence and cybersecurity leadership. If Canadian systems are in any way less protected than ours, they're a vulnerability for us as well. And so partnering with Canada to make sure that we're doing a better job of commercial intelligence sharing, looking at cybersecurity and setting standards, very high standards for what we expect here in North America, I think there's huge potential for that. And the Canadians would be good partners on that. Next up, regulatory mutual recognition. One of the things that will make our supply chains work better is cutting the duplicative red tape of ensuring compliance with various regulatory standards. Canada and the U.S. have a number of standards that are in effect similar or have the same effect, but in practice slightly different. And so we worked since Canada-U.S. Free Trade trying to align our regulatory standards with modest success. I think it's time now, in the interest of improving public sector productivity, to do mutual recognition between the United States and Canada. If Canada proves a product is safe for the market, we should accept that as good enough for the United States and negotiate where we simply have a disagreement. What that will allow us to do, for example, is crash test one set of cars, not do that in Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. It will streamline decisions and it'll help us to move more quickly forward, leaning a little bit on Canada's regulatory capacity as well. Lastly, infrastructure. 74% of trade in North America between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico moves on land. As we look at investing in our infrastructure, I think there's a real opportunity to make priority for infrastructure that supports that trade and to leverage Canada and Mexico to make sure that the infrastructure doesn't stop at the border. It's not a bridge to nowhere, but actually connects us more closely. I have to make this pitch because I follow Canada. I'm not Canadian. I just like them. But I think Canada is a very good partner to start with. First, they're already a partner. Second, we share most of the same firms. We share some of the same enemies, same threats, particularly right now China, but also other places too. We have shared values, particularly when we're looking at things like forced labor or the importance of enforcing sanctions. Canada generally agrees with us on most of those sanctions. And so they have an interest in making sure that we have a high value supply chain. And lastly, and this is something that we've done for decades with the Canadians, establish a model, work out the bugs, and then take that Canada-U.S. partnership and make it the model for our relations with other countries. We can use Canada as, in effect, the first draft partner for improving our supply chain governance and fine-tuning those supply chains to stay competitive.
You can get that full discussion on the C-SPAN website. Coming up next, I'm talking with the head of a STEM organization about getting more people involved in the science of agriculture. We'll be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Here's your segment four for today. The acronym STEM is heard quite often these days. It stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. STEM Connector is an organization that has a goal of getting more people into STEM careers. And a new ebook it has put out focuses on STEM careers in agriculture. Joining me now is Joe Weber, the CEO of STEM Connector and Pod Network. Let's start out with a little bit about STEM Connector. First off, my experience with this, I was raised to love science. So I was just really excited when I got the press release and saw what you're doing. So start off with telling us a little bit about STEM Connector.
Sure. And, you know, STEM Connector is basically a group of people that are passionate about science, technology, engineering, and math. And, you know, if you look at the US economy and you look at some of the biggest companies in the world, it's your Amazons, your Googles, now Alphabet by name, Apple. All of these are massive technology companies. And then other corporations like Walmart, running one of the biggest logistics operations on the planet. STEM is so critically important to the US and to the US economy. It powers about 67% of jobs in the US are STEM or STEM related. Now, one of the challenges we have is that a lot of times young people, maybe they have an early interest in it, but then they drop away. We also see, you know, traditionally, I think you guys know this, women have been discouraged from going into STEM careers. And we've ended up in a position where we have a shortfall. We have a greater need for STEM jobs in the current environment than we have a STEM-ready workforce. So our goal at STEM Connector is to try and help redress that balance, to try and level the playing field, create opportunities for STEM careers and allow those opportunities to be known to all groups so that you can have a more diverse and ready STEM workforce for the future.
You brought up a point about women in science, and I told you I was raised to love science, but I also so very, very clearly remember hearing around the time that I was, 9 or 10, that women weren't meant for science. And that was extremely discouraging. So to have organizations that are proving that that is not true, I think is fantastic. Moving the conversation to science and agriculture, of course, me being involved in agriculture media, I know that there's a lot of science involved in agriculture, but what do you see as far as the connection between food and science?
Sure, and just, Sabrina, just on that point, when I did my PhD, which was a long, long, long time ago, I did a PhD in quantum physics, and I went to the World Gathering of Quantum Physicists at Oxford University, and I was the only woman there. And, you know, I think people were just surprised that there was a woman in this space. So I feel we've come a long way since then, but the numbers are still low. You know, women make up 52% of the population, but only 29% of the STEM workforce. So there's still a lot to be done there. When you look at agriculture, you know, it's the predictions are that our planet right now, we've got about 7.7 billion people on this planet. And I would argue we're not doing a wonderful job with food and food distribution. I think everyone knows there's lots of issues around. Some people have excess access to food. Other people don't have enough. Now, it's predicted that between now and 2050, which is what, that's under 30 years, that the population is going to increase to around 10 billion on this planet. So that's an extra like 2.5 billion people that we're going to have to figure out how to feed between now and the next 30 years. It's a massive challenge. And I think, you know, when you look at this, I think Christine Daugherty from PepsiCo, she, you know, her thing was, is there a more noble cause? And she's got a point. You know, how do we figure out how to feed the planet today and into the future? And a lot of, I think a lot of people think of farming as, you know, you have this, it's a bit like when we say to children, draw a scientist, and they tend to draw a man. You know, think, draw a farm. And people tend to, even though it hasn't been like this for years, they're thinking still plow, you know, some of the hand-pulled plows, that very old stereotypical view we have of farming. And really farming today is, you know, much, much greater use and a need for technology than ever any time before. And if we're going to increase and be able to handle this extra 2.5 billion people, all right, so that's a quarter of the world is over the next, is going to increase by 25% over the next 30 years. If we're going to handle that, STEM is the only way forward. The use of technology, we're not going to be able to be using, you know, to be doing very hand-driven technology, hand-driven workers. We're going to need to embrace the use of technology to be able to both farm and to distribute and store food at that kind of level.
This is going to be a somewhat controversial question, but I want to bring it into the conversation because there seems to be pushback. And you mentioned when, for a lot, in a lot of cases, when people think of farming, they think of, you know, the 1800s or right, not modern day farming. And there seems to be some pushback about allowing science into agriculture. First off, do you think that that is true, or do you see that as well? Or and if so, what can be done about that?
I think, you know, if you look at the US, so one US farm, I think the statistics are right now, currently feeds 166 people or 166 families. There are 2 million farms in the US. There's a lot. It's a lot of farms. It's tricky. If you're a farmer and you've got a relatively small farm, how can you afford the kind of equipment that you need to really take your farm to the next level? And a lot of farms are family, very family centric. So they've been one family for generations. So I think in some ways you're right. There is a, they've been hindered in their ability to use some of the technology that is going to make it much more straightforward, much easier to farm at large quantity levels in the future. So I think there's definitely that situation going on, and not only in the United States, some particularly some poorer regions, very little use of technology. So I certainly see that that's happening. I also think there's a bit of a perception, you know, there's a perception amongst, particularly if you've come from the, and you can tell I'm not originally from the US, but if you've come from the coastlines of the US versus in the middle, if you come from the middle of the United States, there's much more of a focus on, people know about farming and they know what really happens. If you grew up in New York, you probably don't know anything about what farming is and modern day farming. And I know some of our customers, the universities, they have a lot of, they have courses and they have agricultural programs that are designed to really help take students into a career in agriculture. But, you know, as I say, if you're coming out of New York, you might, you're probably not thinking that you're going to end up with a job in agriculture.
We need more people to be involved in agriculture and science moving forward. As you said, we're going to see a lot more mouths to feed around the world on a huge scale. And the STEM Connector recently released an ebook, which I think is the first in a series, and it's geared toward explaining these to people and encouraging science, young scientists to get into agricultural fields. Is that correct?
Very, very much so. So, you know, what we did was we've got a lot of within STEM Connector, we've got a lot of customers that are either completely focused on agriculture or have a part of their businesses focused on agriculture. We also have universities in our network that are focused on agricultural courses and things that are designed, you know, to really be part of the solution here. Universities like Tuskegee, UC Davis is very focused on agriculture and providing and how STEM plays a role in that going forward. So really what we wanted to do was to try and bring all of this together. I mean, that's what we do at STEM Connector. We try to connect. So we were trying to bring this together to really showcase some of the opportunities that are right there, right now, and need to be addressed in agriculture. 50,000 jobs a year on average, new jobs in agriculture. And, you know, again, you're looking for STEM qualified individuals for those jobs. And even today, they cannot fill them. There's not enough qualified candidates for those jobs. And I think a big part of it, as I mentioned earlier, a big part of this is just the belief gap. People don't realize that, you know, with a STEM career, I can actually pursue a career in agriculture. Sorry, with a STEM degree, I can pursue a career in agriculture.
There were a few examples listed on your website or on the STEM Connector website about how technology is used in agriculture. I saw drone bees listed, which I recently was reading about, in fact, and I think that that's fascinating. Autonomous equipment that's used. What are some other examples of ways that you can really use a STEM degree in agriculture?
Well, I think, you know, when you look at agriculture, there's certain things that the drone bees, I mean, it's pretty exciting, right? Bees do the job of pollinating the world for us, right? And we know there's some pressure on bees. So there's some fascinating technologies at that level, which are, you know, very much around the growing of food. But and the harvesting of food, obviously, I think most people are, most of us kind of somewhere in our back of our mind can think of a combine harvester, or we're used to some of the big machinery that we use. But when you start to get to the scale that we need to be here, there's a whole area around logistics. And, you know, I've heard people say that a big problem with food in the world right now is not so much that we don't have enough food, it's that we can't distribute the food effectively to the places where you need it. And anyone that's ever had a kid, and I know growing up when the kid won't eat the vegetable and the parent says, there's people starving in Africa. And the kid will be like, well, send my food to them. And it doesn't work, because by the time it gets there, it's, you know, it can't make the journey. So I think there's still some big challenges for us in food storage and distribution to get food to the world's population. And I think it's going to be on the next generation, this generation coming through, Generation Z, millennials and Gen Z really are the generations that are going to need to try and take their knowledge of science, technology, engineering, and math and apply it to solving some of these problems that we have in agriculture and particularly in agricultural distribution.
I think there's a lot of talk about the generations, but as you said that the next generation's coming up, to me it was exciting because these generations understand about technology and moving things forward and making things happen. So I think it's exciting that this is going to be in their hands. We just, as you mentioned, helping them realize that it can be used in agriculture, not just...
Right, not just going to work for Google. Not that Google isn't a great place, but you know, when you've got your... You go to school and you get an engineering degree or you get a degree in science. You know, our big thing was, you know, again, you know, is there a more noble cause than figuring out how to feed the planet, right? And, you know, just really highlighting some of the jobs and opportunities and what a career in food and agriculture could look like for somebody.
Right. This is fascinating to me, and I could talk about it all day, but they won't let me talk all day. So
me neither.
Right. What would you say are some of the key points that you really want our listeners to know?
I think, you know, it's when you look at something like food and agriculture, just I think understanding how significant it is to the planet, right? You know, it's the basic need of humanity is to be able to eat in order for us to survive. And if you look at this industry that's been around for many, many years, it's not the most diverse industry. And a lot of that has come because it's passing down from generation to generation. And I think, you know, as we look at going forward and being able to really solve the world's hunger needs and to be prepared for a lot more people on this planet and their needs, I think it truly is a great place to consider having a career. And, you know, if you're, I think a lot of, I've seen this a lot with Generation Z and in particular, and I've got two Generation Zs in my household living with me right now. And, you know, I can see it amongst my kids. They're very concerned about these things. And it's not, oh, I'm going to go and become an accountant. I have a 20-year in accountancy. I mean, again, nothing wrong with those. I'm not, don't want to be knocking those, but I can just see my kids are very concerned about trying to help people and trying to be part of something that can help a lot of people. So I think, you know, if you're out there and you're in your STEM career, early on in your STEM career, or you're going to, you know, you're at school and you're thinking, what do I want to be when I grow up? What do I want to be? What shall I do? We just wanted to really highlight that a career in food and agriculture is a you know, potentially a really rewarding place for somebody with STEM capabilities and a STEM background.
All right. I will put a link to the ebook in our show notes, but for people who want to find you online, is there a website they can go to?
Sure. We are stemconnector.com.
Thank you again to Joe Weber. And once again, we have put a link to that ebook in our show notes for today. Also, check out our calendar of events online. Just head to myaglife.com and click on calendar. That is our show for today. If you know of a topic or a person we should feature, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Crew. Thanks for listening.